Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 37th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. Today I continue with the next part of Teddy Roosevelt's book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness, and once again he rattles on about the snakes that he may have to deal with while he's out in the wilds. Then we'll have a musical interlude followed by part 11 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 6. There were a number of us in the room, including two or three photographers. The doctor first put on the table a non-poisonous but very vicious and truculent colubine snake. It struck right and left at us. Then the doctor picked it up, opened its mouth, and showed that it had no fangs, and handed it to me. I also opened its mouth and examined its teeth, but then put it down, whereupon its temper, having been much ruffled, it struck violently at me two or three times. In its action and temper this snake was quite as vicious as the most irritable poisonous snakes. Yet it is entirely harmless, one of the innumerable mysteries of nature, which are at present absolutely insoluble, is why snakes should be so vicious and others absolutely placid and good-tempered. After removing the vicious but harmless snake, the doctor warned us to get away from the table, and his attendant put on it, in succession, a very big lachecis, of the kind called Bushmaster, and a big rattlesnake, each coiled menacingly, a formidable brute ready to attack anything that approached. Then the attendant adroitly dropped his iron crook on the neck of each in succession, seized it right behind the head, and held it toward the doctor. The snake's mouth was in each case wide open, and the great fangs erect and very evident. It would not have been possible to have held an African ring-necked cobra in such a fashion, because the ring-neck would have ejected its venom through the fangs into the eyes of the onlookers. There was no danger in this case, and the doctor inserted a shallow glass saucer into the mouth of the snake behind the fangs, permitted it to eject its poison, and then himself squeezed out the remaining poison from the poison bags through the fangs. From the big lachecis came a great quantity of yellow venom, a liquid which speedily crystallized into a number of minute crystals. The rattlesnake yielded a much less quantity of white venom, which the doctor assured us was far more active than the yellow lachecis venom. Then each snake was returned to its box unharmed. After this, the doctor took out of a box and presented to me a fine, handsome, nearly black snake, an individual of the species called the Masurama. This is, in my eyes, perhaps the most interesting serpent in the world. It is a big snake, 4 or 5 feet long, sometimes even longer, nearly black, lighter below, with a friendly, placid temper. It lives exclusively on other snakes, and is completely immune to the poison of the lachecis and the rattlesnake groups, which contain all the really dangerous snakes of America. Dr. Brazil told me that he had conducted many experiments with this interesting snake. It had not been very common, and prefers wet places in which to live. It lays eggs, and the female remains coiled above the eggs, the object being apparently not to warm them, but to prevent too great evaporation. It will not eat when molting, nor in cold weather. Otherwise, it will eat a small snake every 5 or 6 days, or a big one every fortnight. There is the widest difference both among poisonous and non-poisonous snakes, not alone in nervousness and irascibility, but also in the ability to accustom themselves to out-of-the-way surroundings. Many species of the non-poisonous snakes, which are entirely harmless to man, or to any other animal except their small prey, are nevertheless very vicious and truculent, striking right and left and biting freely on the smallest provocation. This is the case with the species of which the doctor had previously placed a specimen on the table. Moreover, many snakes, some entirely harmless and some vicious ones, are so nervous and uneasy that it is with the greatest difficulty that they can be induced to eat in captivity, and the slightest disturbance or interference will prevent their eating. There are other snakes, however, of which the Masurama is perhaps the best example, which are very good captives, and at the same time very fearless, showing a complete indifference not only to being observed, but to being handled when they are feeding. There is in the United States a beautiful and attractive snake, the king snake, with much the same habits as the Masurama, It is friendly towards mankind, and not poisonous, so that it can be handled freely. It feeds on other serpents, and will kill a rattlesnake as big as itself, being immune to the rattlesnake venom. Mr. Ditmars, of the Bronx Zoo, has made many interesting experiments with these king snakes. I have had them in my own possession. They are good-natured, and can generally be handled with impunity, but I have known them to bite, whereas Dr. Brazil informed me that it was almost impossible to make the Masurama bite a man. The king snake will feed greedily on other snakes in the presence of man. I knew of one case where it partly swallowed another snake while both were in a small boy's pocket. It is immune to viper venom, and it is not immune to colubine poison. A couple of years ago, I was informed of a case where one of these king snakes was put into an enclosure with an Indian snake-eating cobra or hamadryad about the same size. It killed the cobra, but made no effort to swallow it, and very soon showed the effects of cobra poison. I believe it afterward died, but unfortunately I have mislaid my notes and cannot now remember the details of the incident. Dr. Brazil informed me that the Masurama, like the king snake, was not immune to the colubine poison. A Masurama in his possession, which had with impunity killed and eaten several rattlesnakes and representatives of the Lachecis genus, also killed and ate a venomous coral snake, but shortly afterwards itself died from the effects of the poison. It is one of the many puzzles of nature, which the American serpents which kill poisonous serpents should only have grown immune to the poison of the most dangerous American poisonous serpents, the pit vipers, and should not have become immune to the poison of the coral snakes, which are commonly distributed throughout their range. Yet, judging by the one instance mentioned by Dr. Brazil, they attack and master these coral snakes, although the conflict in the end results in their own death. It would be interesting to find out whether this attack was exceptional, that is, whether the Masurama has or not, as a species, learned to avoid the coral snake. If it was not exceptional, then not only is the instance highly curious in itself, but it would also go far to explain the failure of the Masurama to become plentiful. The music for today is by the Adrian Schubert Orchestra, and is called Any Old Time, and this is a 1929 track.
March or May, any old time is lovin' time for me. They say that old King Solomon was the sheik of his town. Now all that I need is some brains and a crown. Because I've got no wife, what a life. Any old time is lovin' time for me. Thank you.
and so on to today's main feature. The marvelous Maureen continues to read
The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft, Part 11. The ghouls made camp amongst the fallen stones of Sarkamand, dispatching a messenger for enough night-gaunts to serve them as steeds. Pikmin and the other chiefs were effusive in their gratitude for the aid Carter had lent them. Carter now began to feel that his plans were indeed maturing well, and that he would be able to command the help of these fearsome allies, not only in quitting this part of Dreamland, but in pursuing his ultimate quest for the gods atop unknown Kadath, and the marvelous sunset city they so strangely withheld from his slumbers. Accordingly, he spoke of these things to the ghoulish leaders, telling what he knew of the cold waste wherein Kadath stands, and of the monstrous Shantax, and the mountain carven into double-headed images which guard it. He spoke of the fear of Shantax for night-gaunts, and of how the vast hippocephalic birds fly screaming from the black burrows high up on the gaunt grey peaks that divide Inquanok from hateful Leng. He spoke, too, of the things he had learned concerning night-gaunts from the frescoes in the windowless monastery of the High Priest not to be described. How even the Great Ones fear them, and how their ruler is not the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep at all, but hoary and immemorial Nodense, Lord of the Great Abyss. All these things Carter glibbered to the assembled ghouls, and presently outlined that request which he had in mind, and which he did not think extravagant, considering the services he had so lately rendered the rubbery dog-like lopers. He wished very much, he said, for the services of enough night-gaunts to bear him safely through the air past the realm of Shantax and Carven Mountains, and up into the old waste beyond the returning tracks of any other mortal. He desired to fly to the Onyx Castle atop unknown Kadath in the cold waste, to plead with the Great Ones for the sunset city they denied him, and felt sure that the night-gaunts could take him thither without trouble. High above the perils of the plain, and over the hideous double heads of those carven sentinel mountains that squat eternally in the grey dusk. For the horned and faceless creatures, there could be no danger from aught of earth, since the Great Ones themselves dread them. And even were unexpected things to come from the other gods, who are prone to oversee the affairs of earth's milder gods, the night-gaunts need not fear. For the outer hells are indifferent matters to such silent and slippery flyers as own not Nyarlathotep for their master, but bow only to potent and archaic Nodens. A flock of 10 or 15 night-gaunts, Carter glibbered, would surely be enough to keep any combination of Shantax at a distance. Though perhaps it might be well to have some ghouls in the party to manage the creatures, their ways being better known to their ghoulish allies than to men. The party could land him at some convenient point within whatever walls that fabulous Onyx Citadel might have, waiting in the shadows for his return or his signal whilst he ventured inside the castle to give prayer to the gods of Earth. If any ghouls chose to escort him into the throne room of the Great Ones, he would be thankful, for their presence would add weight and importance to his plea. He would not, however, insist upon this, but merely wished transportation to and from the castle atop unknown Kadath. The final journey being either to the marvelous sunset city itself, in case of gods proved favorable, or back to the earthward gate of deeper slumber in the enchanted wood, in case his prayers were fruitless. Whilst Carter was speaking, all the ghouls listened with great attention. And as the moments advanced, the sky became black with clouds of those night gaunts for which messengers had been sent. The winged steeds settled in a semicircle around the ghoulish army, waiting respectfully as the dog-like chieftains considered the wish of the earthly traveller. The ghoul that was Pikmin glibbered gravely with his fellows, and in the end Carter was offered far more than he had at most expected. As he had aided the ghouls in their conquest of the moon-beasts, so would they aid him in his daring voyage to realms whence none had ever returned, lending him not merely a few of their allied night-gaunts, but their entire army as then encamped, veteran fighting ghouls and newly assembled night-gaunts alike, save only a small garrison for the captured Black Galley, and such spoils as had come from the jagged rock in the sea. They would set out through the air whenever he might wish, and once arrived on Kadath, a suitable train of ghouls would attend him in state as he placed his petition before Earth's gods in their onyx castle. Moved by a gratitude and satisfaction beyond words, Carter made plans with the ghoulish leaders for his audacious voyage. The army would fly high, they decided, over hideous Leng with its nameless monastery and wicked stone villages, stopping only at the vast gray peaks to confer with the Shantok frightening night-gaunts whose burrows honeycombed their summits. They would then, according to what advice they might receive from those denizens, choose their final course, approaching unknown Kadath either through the desert of Carven Mountains north of Inquanok, or through the more northerly reaches of repulsive Leng itself. Dog-like and soulless as they are, the ghouls and night-gaunts had no dread of what those untrodden deserts might reveal, nor did they feel any deterring awe at the thought of Kadath, towering lone with its onyx castle of mystery. About midday, the ghouls and night-gaunts prepared for flight, each ghoul selecting a suitable pair of horned steeds to bear him. Carter was placed well up toward the head of the column, beside Pikmin, and in the front of the whole a double line of riderless night-gaunts was provided as a vanguard. At a brisk meep from Pikmin, the whole shocking army rose in a nightmare cloud above the broken columns and crumbling sphinxes of primordial Sarkomand, higher and higher, till even the great basalt cliff behind the town was cleared, and the cold, sterile tableland of Leng's outskirts lay open to sight. Still higher flew the black host, till even this tableland grew small beneath them. And as they worked northward over the wind-swept plateau of horror, Carter saw once again, with a shudder, the circle of crude monoliths and the squat windowless building which he knew held that frightful silken-masked blasphemy from whose clutches he had so narrowly escaped. This time no descent was made as the army swept bat-like over the sterile landscape, passing the feeble fires of the unwholesome stone villages at a great altitude, and pausing not at all to mark the morbid twistings of the hoofed, horned, almost humans that dance and pipe eternally therein. Once they saw a Shantok bird flying low over the plain, but when it saw them, it screamed noxiously and flapped off to the north in grotesque panic. At dusk they reached the jagged gray peaks that formed the barrier of Inquanok, and hovered about these strange caves near the summits, which Carter recalled as so frightful to the Shantoks. At the insistent meeping of the ghoulish leaders, there issued forth from each lofty burrow a stream of horned black flyers, with which the ghouls and night-gaunts of the party conferred at length by means of ugly gestures. It soon became clear that the best course would be that over the cold waste north of Inquanock, for Lang's northward reaches are full of unseen pitfalls that even the night-gaunts dislike. Abysmal influences centering in certain white hemispherical buildings on curious knolls, which common folklore associates unpleasantly with the other gods and their crawling chaos, Nyarlathotep. Of Kadath, the flutterers of the peaks knew almost nothing, save that there must be some mighty marvel toward the north, over which the Shantaks and the Carven Mountains stand guard. They hinted at rumored abnormalities of proportion in those trackless leagues beyond, and recalled vague whispers of a realm where night broods eternally. But of definite data they had nothing to give. So Carter and his party thanked them kindly, and crossing the topmost granite pinnacles to the skies of Inquanock, dropped below the level of the phosphorescent night clouds, and beheld in the distance those terrible squatting gargoyles that were mountains till some titan hand carved fright into their virgin rock. There they squatted in a hellish half-circle, their legs on the desert sand, and their mitres piercing the luminous clouds. Sinister, wolf-like, and double-headed, with faces of fury and right hands raised, dully and malignly watching the rim of man's world, and guarding with horror the reaches of a cold northern world that is not man's. From their hideous laps rose evil Shantaks of elephantine bulk. But these all fled with insane titters as the vanguard of night-gaunts was sighted in the misty sky. Northward above those gargoyle mountains the army flew, and over leagues of dim desert where never a landmark rose. Less and less luminous grew the clouds, till at length Carter could see only blackness around him. But never did the winged steeds falter, bred as they were in earth's darkest crypts, and seeing not with any eyes, but with the whole dank surface of their slippery forms. On and on they flew, past winds of dubious scent and sounds of dubious import, ever in thickest darkness, and covering such prodigious spaces that Carter wondered whether or not they could still be within Earth's dreamland. Then suddenly the clouds thinned, and the stars shone spectrally above. All below was still black, but those pallid beacons in the sky seemed alive with a meaning and directiveness they had never possessed elsewhere. It was not that the figures of the constellations were different, but that the same familiar shapes now revealed a significance they had formerly failed to make plain. Everything focused toward the north. Every curve and asterism of the glittering sky became part of a vast design whose function was to hurry first the eye and then the whole observer onward to some secret and terrible goal of convergence beyond the frozen waste that stretched endlessly ahead. Carter looked toward the east, where the great ridge of barrier peaks had towered along all the length of Inquanock, and saw against the stars a jagged silhouette which told of its continued presence. It was more broken now, with yawning clefts and fantastically erratic pinnacles. And Carter studied closely the suggestive turnings and inclinations of that grotesque outline, which seemed to share with the stars some subtle northward urge. They were flying past at a tremendous speed, so that the watcher had to strain hard to catch details, when all at once he beheld, just above the line of the topmost peaks, a dark and moving object against the stars, whose course exactly paralleled that of his own bizarre party. The ghouls had likewise glimpsed it, for he heard their low glibbering all about him, and for a moment he fancied the object was a gigantic shantak, of a size vastly greater than that of the average specimen. Soon, however, he saw that this theory would not hold, for the shape of the thing above the mountains was not that of any hippocephalic bird. Its outline against the stars, necessarily vague as it was, resembled, rather, some huge mitred head, or pair of heads infinitely magnified. And its rapid bobbing flight through the sky seemed most peculiarly a wingless one. Carter could not tell which side of the mountains it was on, but soon perceived that it had parts below the parts he had first seen, since it blotted out all the stars in places where the ridge was deeply cleft. Then came a wide gap in the range, where the hideous reaches of Transmontane Leng were joined to the cold waste on this side by a low pass through which the stars shone wanly. Carter watched this gap with intense care, knowing that he might see outlined against the sky beyond it the lower parts of the vast thing that flew undulantly above the pinnacles. The object had now floated ahead a trifle, and every eye of the party was fixed on the rift where it would presently appear in full-length silhouette. Gradually, the huge thing above the peaks neared the gap, slightly slackening its speed, as if conscious of having outdistanced the ghoulish army. For another minute suspense was keen, and then the brief instant of full silhouette and revelation came, bringing to the lips of the ghouls an awed and half-choked meep of cosmic fear, and to the soul of the traveller a chill that never wholly left it. For the mammoth bobbing shape that overtopped the ridge was only a head, a mitred double head, and below it, in terrible vastness, loped the frightful swollen body that bore it, the mountain-high monstrosity that walked in stealth and silence, the hyena-like distortion of a giant anthropoid shape that trotted blackly against the sky, its repulsive pair of cone-capped heads reaching halfway to the zenith. Carter did not lose consciousness or even scream aloud, for he was an old dreamer. But he looked behind him in horror and shuddered when he saw that there were other monstrous heads silhouetted above the level of the peaks, bobbing along stealthily after the first one. And straight in the rear were three of the mighty mountain shapes seen full against the southern stars, tiptoeing, wolf-like and lumberingly, their tall mitres nodding thousands of feet in the air. The carven mountains, then, had not stayed squatting in that rigid semicircle north of Inquanok, with right hands uplifted. They had duties to perform, and were not remiss. But it was horrible that they never spoke, and never even made a sound in walking. End of part 11.
Maureen, your voice is bringing this creepy tale to life. Thanks again. We're nearing the end of the Dream Quest, and we'll have to move on to other stories soon. So this is an opportune time to remind you that if you've written a creepy or scary story set in or around the 1920s, or a story set anywhen that includes elements of the mythos, the Cthulhu mythos, then please get in touch and let's see if we can get your story onto the show. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk